You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas is making the case for revisiting a landmark ruling on American libel law. The case dates back to 1964. It's known as New York Times versus Sullivan. It helped establish when the media can be sued for libel and what's necessary to win that kind of lawsuit. In an unrelated opinion this week, Thomas called on the court to reconsider the ruling, saying it was policy-driven and, quote, masquerading as constitutional law. Howard Schwaber is a First Amendment expert and professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, glad to be here.
Give us some background on this case, Howard. New York Times versus Sullivan. What led this to the Supreme Court?
So the history of this is fascinating. Libel is one of those areas that goes way back in common law. And up until the 1960s, there was absolute consensus that this was a matter for states to make laws about. There had been federal attempts to make laws about certain kinds of political speech, but in terms of personal libel, this was a matter of state law, and it always had been. In the 1960s, Southern authorities discovered they could use this law as a weapon to shut down the civil rights movement by filing lots and lots of libel suits for enormous sums of money against organizations, and in this case, Supreme Court case, the New York Times, on the grounds that if they had said something that was even the slightest bit false, the slightest error of fact, the slightest misstatement of an event, an Alabama or a Mississippi jury would return a harsh verdict, which would have the effect of draining the coffers of these organizations. It was really a matter of weaponizing a law that for centuries had served a basic civil function. So the Supreme Court was responding to that. And in order to protect the civil rights movement, they established this limit on the idea that any time you say something false about someone, they can sue you. And the limit they established in 1964 was really quite specific. It said elected public officials. If a newspaper, or anyone for that matter, says something about an elected public official that wasn't true, that public official couldn't recover damages unless they met the very high burden of showing that it had essentially been intentionally and maliciously false. What happened in the 20 years that followed is that rule was expanded farther and farther. So it went from protecting people who wanted to criticize elected public officials to people who wanted to criticize anyone who is a public figure, as far as to anyone who wanted to criticize someone who had appeared in the news. And so if you think, for example, about this case of some high school students from Covington Catholic High School in Washington, D.C., and one of those kids is now suing the Washington Post, most experts think he will have a very hard time winning because the fact that he appeared on the news makes him a public figure, and the Washington Post will be protected by this New York Times versus Sullivan rule. So it's become a real impediment to using law and the courts to silence even the most extreme kinds of vitriolic personal attacks on anyone who has any kind of public presence. And there's an argument that it helped open the door to the kind of extraordinarily harsh rhetoric that we see on the internet, for example, in political campaigns these days.
Why do we have these kinds of libel protections for the media?
Well, because if you go back to how all this started in the civil rights movement, without these protections, the traditional libel laws could be used as a weapon by political authorities to silence the press. And certainly, throughout First Amendment doctrine, there's a very, very central idea that a free press is an essential part of a democracy. And Thomas, he made several arguments, and then he appealed to principles of originalism that not everyone will necessarily share. But he raised one really important point, which is that whatever argument you might think makes sense to protect the press against the politically powerful, it's not necessarily the case that you want to extend that same protection to anyone who wants to insult any public figure on the internet.
So Thomas is also saying it seems like we should go back to when the states themselves enforced libel laws. This is something that is beyond the purview of the federal government to say what should happen within any state. What do you make of that?
Right. So Thomas goes much farther than the critique I just made. I suggested, and I think lots of people who study this subject might agree, although others would disagree, that an initially positive idea to protect the free press against the possibility of being attacked by a kind of weaponized version of tort law, of libel, that very positive idea has been expanded to the point where it becomes very, very difficult to protect anyone. Thomas wants to go, in fact, even further. He is, of course, an originalist, the most pure originalist of anyone on the court, And so he would turn the authority right back to the states, despite the dangers that the states will use this kind of law in exactly the way that Alabama did in 1964.
Now, with this case, you mentioned this is Nicholas Sandman, one of the teenagers in this weird incident. It'd take an hour to sum up what may or may not have happened there. But it effectively saying, okay, the Washington Post got the story wrong. This is a everyday person, not a real public figure. They're asking for $250 million in damages, which is incidentally what Jeff Bezos paid for the Washington Post in the first place. Could someone make a case that, like, hey, this is just a teenager out in public? This isn't really a public figure.
Yes, exactly. Now, let me be clear. I think that the teenager's lawsuit is largely frivolous and primarily a kind of a career-launching stunt of a sort. But the idea, but that's not the question. The question is, by what kinds of tests or what kinds of rules should we assess a case like this? And the idea of treating this teenager as a public figure is light years away from the original idea of protecting the ability of the press to criticize elected officials. In this case, from what I know of the case, it doesn't appear the Washington Post did anything particularly wrong. In fact, they were rather careful. And as I say, I think this is a paper-thin lawsuit. But the idea that these standards of protection for criticizing elected officials should be extended to any actor, any musician, anyone who reports, in one famous case, who reports a crime to a journalist, anyone who appears on the internet, that all these people become fair game by this high standard that has to be met before they can sue someone for defamation, that does seem to be a distortion of the 1964 idea of ensuring a press that would have untrammeled ability to critique elected officials. And of course, Justice Thomas is quite right that it has absolutely nothing to do with the way people thought about libel in 1790.
Now, we have figures like Alex Jones, who parents of children killed in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting have sued, accusing him of harassment, defamation for his claims that there were crisis actors, that a shooting never happened. Is there still room in current libel law for a case like that to be successful?
There is, and I should be clear that the Sullivan standard that we're talking about doesn't say no one can be sued. It just sets a very high bar. Alex Jones' actions were so malicious, so frankly vicious, and so obviously deliberate, you know, that it wasn't difficult for the plaintiffs to meet that bar. So it's not as though I used the phrase fair game. That was an exaggeration. It's not as though there are no protections of any kind. But the kind of unmitigated, obviously dishonest vitriol that we've seen directed at public figures in the last 20 years, and it doesn't matter which side of the political spectrum you fall on, you will have, you know, a particular story you want to tell about this, does suggest that we may have gone too far in this judicially invented effort to protect the press and expanded it to a protection for general abusiveness. It's kind of striking that this is one of the very few areas of First Amendment law that no other constitutional court has adopted. There are a lot of American principles that constitutional courts in places like Australia and New Zealand and England and Europe have adopted as inspirations. As far as I know, no other country has adopted the Sullivan rule. And it's not that they haven't thought about it. It's been discussed and rejected.
Interesting. Howard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison, talking to us about libel law and First Amendment protections for the press.